Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Sean Griswold, a reporter with Source New Mexico. We're a nonprofit collaborative newsroom, which means we get to work on important news with our homies here at KUNM. This morning, I'm here to talk about the Albuquerque Indian School, a dark period in the city's history that came to the forefront again this summer when the public came to know about a gravesite that is now a city park. Here, students from Zuni, Apache, and Navajo communities were buried between 1882 and 1933, the most violent period in the U.S. federal boarding school era. This is the time when federal assimilation policies were directed to kill the Indian to save the man. Students were beaten for speaking traditional languages or making attempts to run away. Clothes were military style. Hair was cut short. Their culture was suppressed. Albuquerque Indian School was located in the area north of 12th Street and Interstate 40. The school operated for 100 years before it closed and moved operations to the Santa Fe Indian School. By this point, Pueblo leadership took over the Albuquerque Indian School site and school curriculum structure. They shifted its direction, evolving the school in Santa Fe into an institution that celebrates indigenous heritage, language, and people. They tore down the Albuquerque Indian School campus, developed commercial space, and made a home for the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center. The people that once made up the student rolls at AIS now control the land where the campus sat. You may not know this, but this area is Pueblo Trust land in the middle of Albuquerque. Out of the boarding school era came the self-determination era, where indigenous leaders began to shape and develop our own history to be taught to our children. This continues to this day, with the professional class of indigenous educators operating in K-12 and higher education. But back to the park. In the 1970s, the city of Albuquerque built 4-H Park in a neighborhood just off AIS property. The Albuquerque Journal ran photos on their front page of children's bones found on the site during construction. The park was still completed. A plaque was installed denoting the gravesite. In 2019, it was stolen. This summer, that theft was noticed. People demanded answers. Was the plaque stolen to disrespect and disturb the people buried there? Why was the park built over the graves in the first place? The city of Albuquerque responded. It asked native leaders to propose solutions. It reached out to several tribes about what they'd like to do with the gravesite. Mayor Tim Keller apologized to indigenous people in the city. He signed a proclamation passed by the city council acknowledging the gravesite. What's next? The public can still offer input. It's your time to speak up, Albuquerque. Native and non-native people, what do you want to happen at 4-H Park? Should the city restrict the park and make it a memorial? And if you live in the neighborhood, what would you like to see? Did you attend Albuquerque Indian School or another boarding school? Did your family go to a boarding school and never shared their experiences, or have you asked them? How would you like this history presented in our schools? Give us a call this morning at 505-277-5866. You can also email letstalk@kunm.org or tweet with the hashtag letstalknm. Terry Sloan is Navajo and Hopi. He is the intergovernmental liaison with the city of Albuquerque. He's responsible for outreach to tribal communities regarding 4-H Park and communicating their needs to the city. Thank you for joining us, Terry.
Good morning, Sean, and thank you for having me. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you well, Terry, and you're very welcome. We appreciate you joining us. So I'd like to start by, if you could discuss the city's efforts when 4-H Park made the news in June, why was it important for the Office of Native American Affairs to lead the effort to direct the city's response?
Thank you. That's a good question. First of all, as Sean mentioned, I am Diné and Hopi. I am born of the Kia'ani and born for the Toadlini. Originally born in Shiprock, New Mexico, so I'm actually a New Mexico native. Initially, we found out on June 29th that someone had contacted the Albuquerque Parks and Recreation Department and apprised us of a missing plaque. I think the plaque that was noticed as missing was the one that was a makeshift plaque that was made by the public that was actually placed on a tree that's near the site itself. Because we were aware of the missing plaque back in June 2019, because I actually went down there to see myself that it was missing, and I did report it as missing. But as we were apprised of this new development, we were contacted by the Parks and Recreation Department's public information officer, and myself and Don DeGay, the director of Office of Native American Affairs coordinator, discussed this issue. And one of the things that I thought right away that we needed to do was to implement our Meaningful Tribal Nations protocol that was developed for the city. And so following that process, and then also looking at the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples Free, Prior, and Informed Consent doctrine, that was taken into consideration. Don then subsequently contacted Parks and Recs, who at that time was public information officer, was Jessica Campbell, and she discussed the situation with her and our thoughts on that. Then I followed up with a call to Jessica and Prizer of what I thought we should do, which then included contacting the tribes, the tribal leaders, and any tribal related entity. And then after our call, I then contacted our Commission on American Indian and Alaska Native Affairs Chair, Rebecca Riley, apprised her of the situation, and then gave her my initial thoughts of what I felt we should do. And then I also contacted Will Herrera, who was a Pueblo Council of Governors chair at that time, or chair. And he was a former Pueblo of Laguna governor. So then we talked with him. I talked to him about the situation, and he apprised me that we'd be careful on what we disclose initially to the public until we have more answers as to the situation. Take into account that a lot of these types of situations are usually kept within the tribal communities themselves and the families. So we took care in how we initially brought the discussion out to the public on how we communicated. In the following day, actually. Following our meaningful tribal policy, what we did is then discussing with the mayor's office and then apprising the mayor of the situation, I felt and I apprised him that our meaningful tribal consultation policy that we should identify and as created to create government-to-government relationships and communications, but I felt it was important that he contact the tribes directly. So then what we did is that we contacted the initial tribes that were identified on the plaque, the Navajo, Zuni, and Apache tribes, which included the Hickory and Mescalero Apaches. And so a letter was sent, or a communication was sent from Mayor Keller to the tribal leaders, and we apprised them of the situation and specifics of what we knew at that time. And then the following day, or that night, I also contacted Interior Secretary Deborah Holland and apprised her of the situation, and also New Mexico Indian Affairs Secretary Lynn Trujillo and apprised her of the situation. And the following day, we then contacted the remaining tribes in the state and apprised them of the situation. And so that's kind of how we initially started our responses to alert the tribes as to what occurred and what happened. And then as the days progressed into our response, we then communicated with other Native American organizations and groups that we felt that may need to be apprised of the situation. And so that was our initial response. And then, sorry for being a little confused there.
Terry, that's okay. No, I appreciate you. Yeah, so it really was significant for you to just involve as many of the tribal nations as you could across the state, as well as people who were from Utah and Colorado. But thank you for explaining that initial process. I want to bring in David Simon. He's the director of Parks and Recreation for the city of Albuquerque. David is going to help give us an update as to where we are with the park process itself. David, thanks for calling in today. Thank you.
Yeah, good morning, Sean, to you and your listeners.
Good morning. So the last update we had on the 4-H Park situation was that the city planned to hire a company to do ground-penetrating radar to understand how many remains are buried at the park. Can you just tell us what's the latest on that?
Right. Well, the city, that is the Office of Equity, Inclusion, and the Parks and Rec Department, you know, we've prepared a pretty comprehensive sort of 7-point action plan for 4-H Park. And we are underway in all of the areas of this action plan, which has both short-term, medium-term, and kind of long-term tasks and goals associated with it. One of the first things that we heard loud and clear from both our Pueblo and tribal neighbors, as well as other members of the public, was their real thirst for information about the site. People want to know kind of what is the history of the area, what is there, how much do we know about it, how much do we know about the souls that may have been laid to rest there, their families, so many questions, I think, that were raised, and many of them, the answers are not well known right now. So we took that very seriously, and so what we want to try to do is gather and regather as much information as we can about the history and the site itself. That includes trying to understand what is there. And in recognition of the great sensitivity and sort of sacred aspects of this site, we wanted to do that in the least intrusive way possible. And one of the possible tools available to us is to use technology to understand what is still there on the site under the ground. And so we have focused on a technology called GPR, ground penetrating radar, to try to help us understand what is there. And the city has identified a firm with over 2 decades of experience working with GPR, including a great deal of experience working in burial sites, who's going to assist us in surveying the park property. And, you know, we want to be very careful about that process. So we took sort of a research plan to a very important state panel called the Cultural Properties Review Committee so that, any sort of research plan was well discussed and vetted, because a site like this is it's a sensitive property that kind of falls under cultural resource guidelines. So we wanted to do that the right way. And also we're going to consult more with tribes and pueblos just on this approach. But we're moving toward the ability to start to use this investigative ability now to understand what's there. And we hope very much to get the GPR work underway this year.
Okay, so you think that's going to start before the end of this year?
That is our hope. You know, we still want to make sure we're proceeding the right way with our Pueblo and tribal partners. And, you know, with the tribes and Pueblos being among those groups that really asked for some of this information. So I think that they're generally going to be supportive of us finding out as much as we can about the burial ground. And, you know, we want to just make sure we're doing this the right way, and we're optimistic that we will get the work underway very soon, and it will provide us some very important information.
Gotcha. And then, all right, so we are starting to get some responses in from some people in the city of Albuquerque, and this does also bring in the process of the public comment that Terry was discussing that kind of started next after tribal communities were brought into place. So we'll get back to that here shortly. Stick around, guys. We're talking about the Albuquerque Indian School, the park where a gravesite was found, and how this history should be taught in schools. Were you an alum and want to talk about your experience? Do you have a relative that shared their experience in boarding schools, and how did it affect your relationship? What do you think should be done with the gravesite at 4-H Park? Do you want this history taught in schools? Share your stories and opinions by giving us a call at 505-277-5866 or tweet us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNewMexico. We'll be right back.
UNM Health is a proud sponsor of KUNM, offering a level 1 trauma center at UNM Hospital, where emergency care teams use advanced technology to diagnose and stabilize emergencies with speed and care during critical times for New Mexicans. Support comes from New Mexico Tech and Socorro, presenting Barracutanga, a Latin-flavored band that crosses linguistic and cultural barriers and promotes nonviolence through music. November 19th, tickets at nmt.edu/PAS.
Anthony Barfield wrote this piece thinking about the Big Bang, the idea that the universe expanded from a single point 14 billion years ago. Music contemplating space, matter, and energy. Red Sky by Anthony Barfield on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Sean Griswold, a reporter with Source New Mexico. We're talking about the Albuquerque Indian School and its gravesite where a park was built. 4-H Park could be changed depending on how the city responds to public comment. But the boarding school era is just one piece of history for Native Americans. Indigenous educators are actively writing curriculum to teach students their real history, including that of the boarding school era. They've also developed different approaches to successfully teach Native students, a complete shift from the boarding school model. I'm here joined here with Terry Sloan, who is a tribal liaison with the city of Albuquerque, and Dave Simon, who's the director of Parks and Recreation. I wanted to read you guys a tweet here. This is from Katie Stone. Katie writes us, "Our city needs to make that area a designated graveyard because that's what it is. Perhaps with educational signage explaining it. My kids used to play at that park. I picnicked there. How horrifying we were doing all that over the bones of children." So, Terry, David, is it realistic that 4-H Park could be closed and turned into a memorial?
Sean, I agree. I think it is realistic. We have all options on the table at this point. We did demarcate the area off already. You know, that way we have the area marked off so that, you know, we're apprising the public of what it is, what it's about, and we're asking people to respect that particular area. The part that we know of that's, you know, maybe particularly is the gravesite area is not the full park itself. It's just the northeast corner of the park itself that is where the gravesite actually is. But yeah, it is something that we do have on the table. You know, a memorial we may create, we may completely fence off the area. There's so many thoughts and ideas about this particular issue that we are considering. Again, we're waiting for more detailed input from the tribes, what they would like us to do. And then, of course, the Native community and the family members are going to be chiming in on this issue. And then we are going to be having meetings with the public and the neighborhood itself. We have meetings scheduled in early January to talk with the public to get information, to get truth and thoughts about this particular issue. We're planning one public meeting and then three virtual meetings after that for the public to chime in. So there is a future opportunity for anybody and everybody that would like to participate and give us their thoughts on this issue to chime in. And then we're also documenting everybody's input. So if you could send us that tweet, that would be great. Mm-hmm. That way we have it documented on our end, because we want to create a great information base on what the public would like us to do with that. I don't know if Dave has additional thoughts on that, Dave.
Yeah, well, actually, I did want to ask David, you know, what is the process for the city to close a park?
Well, yeah, first of all, I want to make sure that everybody, again, understands the most sensitive area of the park has been demarcated already and is, you know, closed to sort of typical recreational-focused things that, you know, you might find in a city park. So we've already sort of demarcated it, and we're already sort of employing much more sensitive techniques to manage that area and to take care of it. So we want to be respectful of the area while the public helps us make decisions about its long-term future. And as Terry said, you know, very robust public process will help determine how we approach memorializing this really sensitive site. I think a memorial, you know, is definitely on the table, and quite likely it's almost a universal kind of consensus that people want to be able to properly recognize this area and also show the respect, but also use it as a site for education. You know, not only to show the respect for the history here, but also use it as an educational site that'll help inform our whole community going forward, making it a place of healing and of teaching. So those are ideas that you know, are definitely on the table, and we're kind of looking forward to figuring out how to actualize all that. And I think we look forward to the input on kind of what kind of memorial might be appropriate, and also what are those educational messages. So Ms. Stone's tweet, I think, is clearly in line with a lot of what we've heard from the public.
Excellent. Well, David, that's the perfect transition now, because, you know, speaking on the education process and how we teach this history, I'm going to transition now and talk to some individuals who are actively part of this effort to teach the history of the boarding school era, as well as additional indigenous history for our students. Valerie Sayo is from Laguna Pueblo. She drafts curriculum with the Native American Community Academy Inspired Schools Network. She's their senior director of education and transformation. NACA started in Albuquerque, and the network now has schools in tribal communities across New Mexico and North America. Thank you for joining us, Valerie.
Good morning, Sean. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're very welcome. So to begin, how would you describe the work you do as an evolution from the boarding school era?
Yeah, I think it's pretty significant that NACA's main campus, the kindergarten through eighth grade campus, lies on the property of the old Albuquerque Indian School, and is really a counter to what transpired there many, many years and generations ago. NACA was founded back in 2006, and it really was the hopes and dreams of the Native urban community here in Albuquerque to really have a say and to really create that vision for what was taken away. You know, a lot of our ancestors' cultural identity was taken away, our language was stripped away, but schools like NACA and many of the other schools that exist in our network are really about centering language, about centering culture in their mission. And so if you're familiar with NACA's mission, it's really about uplifting cultural identity, holistic wellness, and of course making sure that students are academically prepared. And so since its inception, NACA has really focused on, you know, having courses like Native literature for reading, having Indigenous history, Indigenous science as key components in what students are learning, and also cultivating their identity. So, yeah, a lot of the work that we've been doing for the last 15, 16 years has really been looking at curricula. How are we incorporating identity in those pieces? How are we talking about, you know, the true history of what happened on this continent, and, you know, helping students cultivate that sense of pride in who their ancestors were? There's Indigenous genius that, you know, has not been highlighted in the typical schooling experience for many of our Native students. And so that's a lot of the work that's been started at NACA and has been happening across the state with a lot of our schools in the network, as well as other schools throughout the country that are part of our network.
Yeah, and students at NACA, either through lived experience or through educational experience, are aware of the boarding school era, are aware that there's that connection through their history. Maybe they had a relative that attended a school, or they just know about it just from talking within, you know, their own community. So what grade do students in the network learn about the boarding school history? And would you be able to describe a little bit about what they do learn?
Yeah, you know, we've been doing Native literature, so NACA, excuse me, I drank water and tried to get my voice ready. But for whatever reason, maybe because it's a colder morning, apologies. Yeah, we started NACA with grade 6 and, of course, went to high school. Then, you know, we ended up going the whole gamut from kindergarten to 12th. But in 7th grade, in the Native literature curriculum that we've just recently, not recently, but we've made it available and open source to the public, but it's been built off of previous, since its inception. So 7th grade has a really long, comprehensive boarding school unit in this curriculum, and it's looking at various perspectives and looking at actual historical fiction texts, and then asking students to think about, you know, what's the history of schooling in your own family, and what are some of those stories? So seeing stories as texts. And so in this particular unit in seventh grade, students are asked to interview a family member, and whether they were a boarding school survivor or not, but, you know, just learning from what their experience was, and then shifting it to their experience as a NACA student. So, you know, they're seeing actual literature as a narrative. They're seeing their family stories and histories as a narrative, and being able to analyze both. And, you know, some of those understandings that they're taking away are like looking at equity, looking at justice, and you know, strengthening their ties to who they are and what they lost and what they're gaining now, being a product of a school that really centers identity, language, and culture.
Got it. I want to bring Terry back into this to get a response. You know, we just heard a little bit about what the NACA model is and how they teach their Indigenous students. That serves, you know, several hundred students from Albuquerque or from tribal communities around here that learn in Albuquerque. But APS, the public school district, the largest in the state, has thousands of Native American students. And so, Terry, I guess I'd like to understand a little bit about what your office is doing, or mission or goals that your office has when working with Albuquerque Public Schools to teach and promote Indigenous curriculum and history with APS?
Thank you, Sean. That's another good question. We are working really very closely with APS and Indian Ed, particularly with the interim senior director, Phil Farson. And we are really promoting, because one of the things that I wanted to do when I first came in as an intergovernmental tribal liaison is bring in my work that I do with the United Nations. I've done work as a director of my NGO, South Asiatic Cultures, and worked with the United Nations since 2011. And we're always working to elevate Indigenous peoples, our culture, our language, our styles, our ways of being, and our science, etc. So bringing that philosophy myself into the Office of Native American Affairs, I felt that we really need to create that type of environment for the city in collaborating with APS. And so we have been working closely with APS. We've collaborated with them on Indigenous Peoples Day events, Native American Heritage Month events. I was working initially closely with the former director, Daisy Thompson, and we were creating programs to elevate the Native American, the face of the Native American, the voice of the Native American, because one thing that we do see here is that there's always this picture of this Native American that it is not so great. You know, the person that is subject to substance abuse, et cetera, et cetera. And so we were working at that level to educate people about these issues that we face as Native Americans in the city, because there are over 60,000 Native Indigenous peoples in the city of Albuquerque, representing over 400 tribes. And so we continue to want to work to educate the public about who we are. We just recently had an Indigenous Life Celebration event this past Saturday, where we celebrated Indigenous people, who we are. And our planning committee consisted of members of the city, of course, myself, Don Begay, APS, the National Indian Youth Council, the New Mexico Workforce Development, and members of the Americans for Indian Opportunity. And what we did is we allowed the students from APS to create this event. They created the agenda. They contacted the individuals that are going to be part of the whole presentation process. So we gave the high school students a chance to create this event for us, and we just helped guide them and complete the various end product and brought it together as a whole. And so it was a very successful event. We probably had over 400 participants, considering COVID was there. And we're continuing to create these types of events. We'll be having more events next year. So keep apprised on the city's website, APS websites, and other websites. We're working to create a master website that would contain information about events that are tied to Native American, Indigenous peoples' issues, culture, language. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all promoting that from our end and wanting to develop that further for the city. We're educating the city departments on Native and Indigenous people's issues. I just recently held a listening session to talk about tribal sovereignty. We just had one yesterday that talked about who we are, who are Native Americans in this city or in this state or in the United States. And then I have another consultation, learning session coming up that's going to talk about working with the tribes. So we are really working closely and wanting to develop further programs with APS to help elevate more understanding and education about Indigenous and Native American people.
All right. Well, we're here talking about the Albuquerque Indian School, the park where the gravesite was found, and how this history should be taught in schools. Did you attend a boarding school or have family that did? Share your story by giving us a call, 505-277-5866, or tweet us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. Terry, I want to ask you one more quick question regarding a follow-up to what you were just discussing. In terms of classroom instruction, getting a lesson plan, getting a curriculum model based on the boarding school era in Albuquerque, from your perspective, what is it going to take, or how far away are you from having this taught in the history of boarding schools in Albuquerque public school classrooms?
We have discussed this issue at length, and we are looking at our options on creating curriculum for this particular issue. As Dave mentioned, and as we also discussed it with our strategy working group team, that we have an opportunity here to talk about this issue, to educate the public about the Indian school issue. There's a lot of information out there. There's studies that we have looked at from Dr. Ted Ahola, Mr. Joe Sabatini, and then we also have looking at archives of the situation here in Albuquerque from the Presbyterian Church and their historical archives. But I think we are close. We have a lot of information. There's so much out there about this right now. We're also collaborating with the U.S. Department of Interior's Boarding School Initiative. We'll be working with their team on this particular issue. And once we have a better grasp of what occurred here in Albuquerque, there is a lot of information about it, we will further look at how we can create that education piece to be taught in the school. We are looking at, as Dave mentioned, if we most likely will create a memorial site at the park itself, we are going to have education materials there. We're actually going to create a subcommittee on how that would look like, what the education will be. We're going to talk with the public. We're going to bring in education professionals, historians, cultural leaders to talk about this issue. So we're going to create an information piece that's going to be created by the people, Native Americans, the tribes, input, et cetera, on explaining what occurred. Because we want the historical perspective to be correct from our perspective on how we think it should be said and presented to the public.
All right.
So, in looking at creating an education curriculum, we'll be doing the same thing.
Okay. Well, you know, we have Valerie Sayo here. She is a curriculum, works on drafting and creating curriculum. Valerie, I want to bring you back into this because you're an incredible resource with the research that you do and that you've already completed. Can you discuss a little bit about some of the sources for the boarding school lesson plans that have been developed for NACA students?
Yeah, thank you. You know, I think a lot of it has been our own community. One of the things that we were really proud of at NACA, and as you mentioned, Sean, I'm not at the school, but I did spend 9 years teaching at NACA, teaching Native literature. And, you know, we were proud of the fact that all of our administration were Native educators, and a good majority of our staff were Native as well. And so we really relied on the cultural community capital that many of our teachers brought and expertise to help design this curriculum. A lot of what we developed, well, actually all of what we've developed so far has been teacher designed. So the lived experience of teachers, of their family histories. And as we've improved at the curriculum design process, we've built a layer of community input. So as we went into designing this portion, which is the 6th through 12th Native literature curriculum, which includes the boarding school units, right now we're currently working on a K through 5 grade level curriculum as well. And this has all been started.
Excellent. Yeah, so it is about the community, and that's really what we're looking for today. We want some more community input on this. Do you have an opinion on what should be done with the gravesite at 4-H Park? Did you attend a boarding school or have family that did? Please give us a call, share your story, and give us a call at 505-277-5866 or tweet us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. We'll be right back.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, inside the labor battle against big tech in California, it could change the future of work.
All the school drivers like me, we put the time and money and effort to make Uber and Lyft who they are right now.
That's next time on Latino USA.
That's Latino USA, Monday mornings at 8 a.m. on KUNM.
On the next alternative radio, hear Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on the other side of Thanksgiving. That's Alternative Radio, Saturday evenings at 6, right here on 89.9 FM KUNM, KUNM.org, Albuquerque.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Sean Griswold, a reporter with Source New Mexico. We're talking about the Albuquerque Indian School and the grave site where students were buried that is now a city park. What would you like to see happen to 4-H Park? Are you an AIS alum or attended an Indian boarding school? We're also looking to the present and future, where education reform is happening right now with people like our guest, Valerie Sayo, and soon I'll be introducing another one named Josh Krause, who are just one of the many educators reframing and retelling the real history of the Native American experience in North America. If you have a story to share, please give us a call at 505-277-5866. So now I'm going to bring in here, we're joined by another educator, as I mentioned, who develops curriculum for Indigenous students. He works with NACA, APS, and other tribal schools. Josh Krause is a self-described settler, a white man from southern New Mexico who has developed strong relationships working with tribal communities for many years. Hey, thank you for joining us, Josh.
Thank you for having me, Sean.
Yes, Josh, you know, I want to get to know more about you and how you transformed your career to work with Indigenous communities. But first, would you like to share some of the inspiration of from the Indigenous educators that support you and keep you motivated to continue working with these communities?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I've worked at NACA for about 12 years and with the Inspired Schools Network since its inception. I get so much more out of working with the school, and I've learned so much more from the school and the teacher designers and students that come from the school than I've given back. But I think I've been welcomed in to various communities, not to impart any knowledge that I have, but to act as a convener and coalescer of genius in Indigenous communities for community-led curriculum and community-led school design.
All right. So how did you get into working with Indigenous communities, and what have you learned that's helped you develop into a successful ally?
Yeah, a few years after the Native American Community Academy opened up, Ms. Bobroff, the founder of the school, and I had a relationship through Central New Mexico Community College, and I was working on curriculum development with teachers in an alternative teacher program. So I came to NACA, and NACA, as I noted a moment ago, was full of folks from various Indigenous communities who brought their own wisdom, their own ways of life, their own language. And we were looking as a school at how to develop a comprehensive curriculum from grades 6 through 12 at the time, and now grades K through 12. And to be able to have complex conversations about expectations for students and depth of understanding for students and performance tasks for students. And so we adopted a curriculum framework called Understanding by Design, which Val and I and others have now begun to transform into a process and a product called Indigenous Genius by Design that is really rooted in community-led design and centers on teacher designers as having the expertise to build their own curriculum.
Great. Hey, Valerie, I want to bring you back in and talk a little bit more about that concept, Indigenous Genius by Design. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, you know, it's looking at our own community members who who have a lot to share, and it's really centering, you know, what are the values, what are the big ideas, the concepts that are important for our children to know that really frame their identity. I was really fortunate in that I was working with my Pueblo Laguna a few years ago on creating some language curriculum, and having gone through this process of bringing our elders, our speakers to the table and asking them, what does it mean to be Goekamer? What does it mean to be Laguna? What are some of those things that we really need to make sure our students have access to? And so, you know, from that experience and from working at NACA, developing curriculum, you know, we were seeing a lot about how we bring community to the table, and not just in this setting. In many of our network schools, they go through this setting, because it's not like if you want to make sure that you have an Indigenous history course at your school, you can't go off to some publisher and ask for that. A lot of this has to be originally designed with the community leading the way. So it's bringing in knowledge keepers, elders, and asking them important questions that are really going to cultivate understanding for students. And then the teacher does the work of, you know, putting in the thinking about, you know, how will I develop this lesson in a way that students are going to build understanding? How am I going to build an opportunity for students to show what they know? And a lot of this is looking at performance-based assessment, where students are, you know, not doing writing, not doing paper and pencil tests, but they're showing what you know in an authentic way. And hopefully that also includes community, whether that be like a community night where they're sharing their learning, if it's, you know, thinking about their Indigenous language class and how they're, maybe it's like using the language in context with community. So looking at assessment in a different way and building with community together.
Okay. So I want to read both of you. We got a tweet here from Maggie Juno. Maggie writes us, how can what happened at boarding schools be omitted? How? I'm tired of dumb ideas. How will society ever evolve if leaders bury the BS that they willingly did? And I asked that question to understand within your curriculum development, and this is either for Josh or Valerie, do you teach students the concept of why history has been omitted and why we're just learning about it now?
Josh, you want me to take that?
Sure.
So, how do you instruct students about history being omitted and why this is being present, you know, now? Why is it taking this long to get to know about it?
Yeah, you know, I think that at least when I was a teacher at NACA, a lot of how we approached it was, you know, sharing as a teacher, sharing my own story. And I think part of that has been, you know, why do I do the work that I do? Why did I become a teacher? And it was because I went through my whole K through 12 experience, not really knowing the true history of what happened on this continent. It wasn't until I went to college that I, you know, was able to take Native American Studies courses, and I actually learned about things like allotment, things that happened outside of my Pueblo bubble here. And that was infuriating to me. Why did it take me having to pay for my education to get this kind of information, this kind of knowledge? And so when I became a teacher, I always knew that I wanted to work with Native youth. And when I had that opportunity, you know, just sharing, like looking at, you know, I hate to look at our communities in a deficit-based way, but you look at all the traumas that have happened, the way it shows up in our communities with alcoholism, you know, with poverty. Those things are definitely a result of the traumas that our people have experienced. And, you know, you haven't been able to always get this information readily available in your K through 5 experience. But, like, you know, having to draw that, but also spending explicit time on, like, you know, the story of the genius that does exist. So, it really starts with just stories and the personal narrative that you as an individual who's working with students can share. And that opens up a
All right. We're going to go into a little bit more of our reaction from our listeners. I have one more tweet to read. This one's from Shiloh Craig. The bare minimum for 4-H Park is to close and educate. Safe guess if you told Burkenios that Coronado was buried there, it would become a massive shrine of erasure. With that one, we're going to transition to a caller now. We have Rhonda calling in from Santa Fe. Rhonda, are you there? Rhonda calling in from Santa Fe. All right. Well, we're going to we're going to get to her just here in a little bit. I want to bring it back over to Josh. Josh, I have a question for you. Do you have any advice for new teachers or college students about to enter the field, or even professionals looking to pivot and work with tribal communities? Who do they need to read? You know, do you have any book recommendations for anybody who's interested in working with Indigenous communities who's non-Native?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I wanted to deal really quickly with some of what Val said. I think, you know, if you look at our curriculum, which, as she said, is open source and available on the internet to anyone who wants to use it and check out the text that we use for Native literature, 6th grade through 12th. But one of the things that balances is this idea of Indigenous identity and joy explicitly as one of the guiding, spiraling big ideas in our curriculum. And I think that's balanced with the real world look that you're asking about, how the school and the curriculum sort of takes the gloves off with students in a way that traditional education has really understood students as, you know, vessels to be filled with information. But we really believe at NACA and our other schools that students have agency and they have voice, and we need to help them develop that so that they can advocate in the future and answer some of these questions. I would love to have our students who study boarding schools in 7th grade have a conversation with Terry and the other gentleman from Albuquerque Parks on what should happen, because they are actually scholars within this field. And I think in general, you know, that's a lesson that we all need to take as a white man from southern New Mexico. I think that I need to have a real conversation about the history of colonization. And I need to be able to, you know, at one time be able to respect the idea of Thomas Jefferson and life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and at the same time, own that he was the slaveholder, and hold both of those ideas in my head at the same time as a true representation of history. In terms of where teacher candidates should go for more information, we have a wealth of knowledge and expertise within our own communities. I would say show up and listen to the community, to the parents, to the families, to the elders that you're designing curriculum for. I would also say that Dr. Martinez and Dr. Lee and Dr. Sims at the University of New Mexico offer courses that are incredible in challenging the epistemologies that have guided education for Indigenous students and non-Indigenous students for decades. And there's some real value in what teacher candidates can take out of those programs.
Excellent. Thank you for that response. And to that point, let's go listen to some of the community. I think we got our caller set up now. We're looking at Randa. Randa from Santa Fe. You there now?
Hi, yes. I'm not Indigenous. However, I have been involved in the adoption circle support group, and in that capacity, I learned about a young woman who was trying to get her baby back, Native woman, in San Francisco, and she and her mom stayed with me to go to court. But her story was her mother was a student at the Albuquerque Indian School back in the 1970s, and young, scared woman, I don't know the history, she got pregnant, she gave birth, this little baby girl, and within a block of the school, she put this little baby on someone's doorstep with a little sign on the baby. It said Pima Apache. So here's another example of what the boarding schools do to people, and I've tried to help her now, you know, that she's an adult, find her mother, and with no success. But I just thought that needs to be part of the educational history too, that these things happened. Here she was. The baby was born on August 16th, 1970, and That's the story. It was on the front of the paper, the Albuquerque, whatever the paper was, in 1970. Mm-hmm. But she got adopted out to Anglo parents in Las Cruces. And then in 1989, she and her mom flew out to San Francisco and stayed with me and went to court to get her baby back. It was in foster care with a white woman that wanted to adopt the baby. And we all went down to the Indian Center to potluck one night, and there was a whole lot of prayer and support for her. She got her baby back. But she's, you know, intergenerational trauma of the boarding schools, the impact on this family. I just wanted to share that. I think it's very important because that whole adoption scenario and getting pregnant and, you know, that I'm sure that this is just one of many cases similar to this. This mm-hmm. one just got a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Randa, thank you very much for sharing that story. We're going to go to our next caller, Colleen. Colleen, you wanted to talk about some book recommendations that could help. What do you have to share?
Yes. Let's see. Bartolomé de las Casas, a short account on the destruction of the Indies. I think that's probably like, you know, if you're a teacher and you haven't, you know, I think that's something that would be informative and kind of help a teacher to understand the space that a Native student might be in if they read that. And that was published 50 years after the Columbus's first voyage by a Franciscan monk who was on Columbus's second voyage. And so there's a lot of people who will say, I've seen on the internet recently that, you know, this is fake and, you know, this experience that people, natives had is not true. And so I just, you know, tell them here's a book that was published.
Yeah, Colleen, give us the name of that book one more time.
It's called A Short Account of the Destruction of the Indies. It's by Bartolomé de las Casas. There's also Power of a Navajo by Carl Gorman, The Man and His Life. And so for New Mexico history class, I've had my high school students, when I was teaching social studies, I would have them read some of that because it does the co-talkers, but also shares his personal account and experience of boarding school and when he was chained in the basement by a principal in Gallup because he wouldn't stop speaking Navajo. And so I think there's some really interesting perspectives there on the boarding school experience. But there's quite some others, but I guess you have to look for those. But those are two I wanted to share away.
Colleen, thank you very much for sharing. Let's go to our next caller. We got Jose calling from Española. What's going on, Jose?
Hey, good morning, and thank you for giving me a moment to speak. I wanted to just share a little bit of my experience working with NACA through various their community collaborations. You know, NACA is a great model for schools. In fact, my daughter goes to school at NACA. And I, you know, one thing I always really appreciated as a traditional New Mexican person who, you know, we follow along the lines of understanding history as it's told to us. One thing is many New Mexicans are indigenous and we think that we're Hispanic. And I always really appreciated that NACA allowed for New Mexican students to identify with their indigenous heritage and tapped into the histories, the real histories that we don't learn in schools about who are the so-called Hispanic people and the Spanish myth. And then beyond that, tapping into the community resource, service learning is a powerful tool to teach young people who they are, and it works to build unity across in the many vast indigenous identities. And just wanted to give love and respect to folks at NACA and all their leadership.
Jose, thank you so very much. We're coming to the end of the hour today, but the conversation doesn't end here. Please share your comments with us at KUNM.org or look for Source New Mexico on social media channels like Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram and connect with us there. And you can also hit me directly on Twitter by following Sean505. And many thanks to our guests today, Terry Sloan, Valerie Sayo, David Simon, and Josh Krause. Thank you, everyone. If you missed any of our program or if you'd like to share it with friends, the audio of this show will be posted at KUNM.org, where you can also find previous shows. And on the post for this show, you will find links to free resources, including the lesson plans Valerie said are available to share. Thanks to Mario Marino Spencer, our engineer today. Taylor Velasquez took your calls. Robert Maldonado, Patrick Lohman, live tweeted the show for KUNM, and Patrick Lohman live tweeted the show for Source New Mexico. Megan Kamrick is the executive producer. I'm Sean Griswold from Source New Mexico. This is KUNM. We'll be right back.